Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
In the mid-1970s, women all over the country... Where's that music coming from?
Hey, it's a party, it's a party.
What are you doing here?
It's a party,
I thought you'd quit.
It's a party. I'm back, baby. It's a party. Jamie, John, you guys know that there is no way that I ever would have missed the 100th episode of True Crime Cast. I know that we had our knockdown, drag-out fight there on our Patreon episode, which listeners can get for only $3 a month, but still, with that in mind, there is no way I could have bailed on you all for number 100. To be honest, John, Jamie, I want to thank you guys. On behalf of everyone else out there that listens to True Crime Cast, you guys provide quality content to tens of thousands of individuals every single week. When we first started this, there is no way that we would have known that we would have gotten to this point. And I can't wait to see where we go in the future. You guys are the definition of igniting conversation.
Thanks, man. We're glad to have you back.
Guys, I've missed doing the read. Do you mind if I come back?
It's all yours, man.
There are murderers, there are serial killers, and then there's Ted Bundy. His reign of terror in the 1970s is one of the most infamous series of murders in American history. Bundy is known for many things: his charisma and charm, his good looks, his intelligence, and the fact that he was one of the most evil criminals that we have ever covered on this show. What created this monster? How did he get away with so many murders? And what impact did his case have on how we view serial killers today? This is the 100th episode of True Crime Cast.
Welcome to the 100th episode of True Crime Cast. I realize that we're going to talk about a lot of serious stuff today. That's what this show's about. But we really feel good about making it this far, so we wanted to do a little celebrating. John, did you ever think we'd make it here?
I really thought we would quit after like maybe 15. So to be sitting here 100 later is kind of phenomenal. We've come a long way, but that's mostly because of you guys, the listeners. Thank you all so much for sticking it out with Jamie and I for over 100 episodes. Thank you so much.
We really do appreciate it, guys. And to show our appreciation today, we are just going to jump right into this episode. And we've been planning this one for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about this case for what feels like a year. I know for sure at least several months. So you have done all the research for us. Why don't you get us rolling?
Yeah, I mean, how can you have a true crime podcast and not talk about Ted Bundy? He's one of the most notorious serial killers in American history. Netflix has just been blowing up with, there's a documentary that came out in the last year. There's a Zac Efron movie. Have you watched either or both of those?
I've seen a little bit of the documentary, but I have not seen the Efron movie, but that is on my to-do list for sure.
Yeah, I think it's really well done. Of course, the movies, there's always going to be some inaccuracy, but I think it did a pretty good job. And this is also, this year is the 30th anniversary of when Ted Bundy was executed. So I think it's somewhat timely that we're able to do this. And we had planned a long time ago to save this for number 100. So we're excited. But before we get into the monster that was Ted Bundy, we wanted to share a story about a young lady that survived a Ted Bundy attack and really showed an amazing amount of strength to eventually tell her story. And that lady's name is Rhonda Stapley. Rhonda Stapley was a first-year pharmacy student at the University of Utah in 1974. And we'll go into a little later how Ted Bundy ended up in Utah, but we're going to talk about an incident that occurred on October 11th. So I mean, she's a first-year pharmacy student there. She's been there for a couple months. And then something completely unexpected happens. John, she had to go to the dentist that morning, which any day going to the dentist, at least for most people, they don't look forward to that. She was just going to have a routine filling, but the numbing medication that they end up using on her, John, she had an allergic reaction to it. So they actually had to open her up and surgically treat this reaction she was having to the numbing medication. So she went in just to have a simple filling and go about her day, and she ended up having full surgery, and she had stitches in her mouth and everything. So she's coming out of the dentist, and it's been a really rough morning. I'm sure she was debating whether just to go back and sleep or to go on to class, but she comes up to the bus stop at Liberty Park and realizes she's going to be waiting for a while for the bus. She had just missed one. And then somebody pulls up in a tan Volkswagen Beetle and offers Rhonda a ride.
So the driver of this Volkswagen Beetle was a very handsome man. He was very polite, almost charming. And he said that he needed to run an errand near the zoo. So offered to pick her up and take her where she needed to go. When they started driving, he turned away from the university and actually drove by the zoo. So naturally, she kind of stopped and asked, why did you drive by it? And he said, well, my errand was near the zoo, not at the zoo. So they ended up keep on driving. They end up at Big Cottonwood Canyon. Now, so you can imagine, you know, she's probably a little bit out of it, but she's still with it enough to think, what the crap is going on here? She believed that he was about to make some kind of pass at her. Maybe he wanted to make out with her, or he was hoping for some kind of sexual encounter, but she was not interested at all in this. She felt a little uneasy by the whole thing, and she was going to turn him down. So the driver parked the car and looked at her. And again, she thought she was going to be asked for a kiss or to make out, but instead the driver told her that he was going to kill her, and he began choking her.
So, I mean, you can't even imagine what's going through her mind at this point. It's been an awful day already, and then she gets in a situation that's already uncomfortable, and then something that you would never expect this to happen, somebody threatening her life and actually assaulting her. So she started fighting back. I mean, she was kicking, punching, I mean, everything you can do to defend yourself. But eventually, his grip around her neck was successful, and she went unconscious. She woke up sometime later. She didn't know how long it was, but she was laying on a picnic table at the park at that Big Cottonwood Canyon. On that picnic table, the man continued to assault her. He hit her. He choked her in and out of consciousness, John. So he would choke her out, wait for her to wake up, and then do it again just to torture her. She was crying and begging for mercy, and for some reason, that seemed to make him angry, according to Rhonda. And he actually yelled at her that instead of whining and crying, she should be thankful that she was still alive and he was letting her live. So he made her say out loud that she was grateful to still be alive. And then he made her show that by performing oral sex on him. He then put her back on the picnic table. He pulled her pants down. She was wearing really big boots, so he couldn't get them over her shoes. But he pulled her pants down around her ankles and he sexually assaulted her. So he walks away, and here she is laying on this table, beaten, assaulted, raped, and she thinks she has an opportunity to make a break for it.
Yeah, man, this guy's a freaking monster, right? So he ends up turning away from her to get something out of his car, and when he does, she feels like this is her chance to escape. So she takes off running. And while she's running, dude, she actually trips and falls. Now, when she falls, what would you be thinking? Like, crap, I had my one chance and I blew it, right? Well, she actually fell into a river, right? So this river is actually like almost, I would say, a roaring rapid kind of situation. Like the water is moving pretty swiftly. So as she falls in, she is quickly swept away from this monster. So now she's afraid that she's going to die because of this river. So this is like the worst day imaginable for her. But she's able to stop herself on a branch that's hanging over the river. And she's able to climb herself out. Jamie, she walks 4 miles back to civilization out of this canyon. But I'm sure just that's time spent away from the monster that brought her here. So, at least she's somewhat safe now.
Yeah, she's such a brave, tough person, and that shows throughout the story. From the road, once she got out of the canyon, she could see a giant U painted on the side of a hill over by the university. And although it was late at night, the university had a bunch of lights set up to kind of shine on that U to illuminate it. So that became kind of her beacon to follow to get to safety. She got back to her apartment, which is where she went first. She had decided not to go to the police. She bathed for hours. And of course, you hear stories about people that are sexually assaulted and they say you just can't get yourself to feel clean. And then she slept for almost an entire day. Rhonda didn't go to class for a number of days, John. She stayed in her room. She slept a lot. I'm sure she cried a lot. She was going through so much. And she decided that this was such an embarrassing situation. She felt so shameful about everything that she still wasn't going to report it to police. When she finally did go back to class, I mean, her face was still swollen from the beating that she took from Ted Bundy. And she told people it was from the dental surgery that she had had, that she was just puffy from that. She eventually saw on the news the story of Carol DeRanch and a man that was arrested for attacking and trying to kidnap her. And that man's name was Ted Bundy. And that's when Rhonda realized this was the same man that had attacked her. So then she decided, you know what? He's been caught for attacking this other lady, so there's no need for me to go in with more information. He's been caught. She would eventually find out that he had killed several women, and she did express that she felt some guilt because she didn't report him earlier in hopes that he could have gotten caught earlier and not killed as many people.
I can't imagine what this poor lady was feeling. You know, not only has she been brutally attacked and, you know, her life was seriously in jeopardy, but now she's living with the fact that some guilt there that she may have been able to help other people. But before you criticize her or try to beat her up anymore, I mean, it's not uncommon for victims to not want to talk about this kind of assault and sexual assault. You know, it's embarrassing. You know, you feel like there's something wrong with you, even though there's nothing at all wrong with you. So it's not uncommon at all for victims not to want to talk about this. So she didn't, and she did not talk about her attack for 42 years. And in that time, Jamie, I can't imagine how much post-traumatic stress disorder she dealt with. And, you know, every time she probably closed her eyes for a long time, she probably saw the monster's face as she closed her eyes. So my heart goes out to this poor woman. And I know we're going to talk about a lot of other women who weren't fortunate enough to escape and did not make it out. But Rhonda ended up telling her husband that she was sexually assaulted, but that she didn't say that it was by Ted Bundy. So eventually she found another Ted Bundy survivor online, and that person encouraged her to write about the experience that she had and almost use that as an opportunity for therapy. Like, this could be a therapeutic experience or an exercise to get some of that out. So this led to her sharing her story and writing a book called I Survived Ted Bundy, The Attack, Escape, and PTSD That Changed My Life. She was one of the few survivors of serial killer Ted Bundy, and this really changed the way that our country looked at murder, and just we really got a glimpse to see just how freaking awful this guy was and how big of a monster he was. We wanted to share this story just before we go into all the other ones. There's a lot of people, like I said, who weren't able to survive his attacks, but we just wanted you to know that, you know, his victims probably did fight back, and she was one of the few people who survived, and I think it's a really important story to get out there.
Yeah, so now we're going to tell you about Ted Bundy, talk to him about his childhood, and then go into the crimes that there's a lot out there about, and some that maybe there are not. He was born November 24th, 1946 in Vermont. His family situation was really complicated, John. He was raised by his grandparents and told that his real mother was actually his sister. So he was raised in a family thinking that these people were his parents and his sister, when in reality, that was his birth mother and his grandparents. His mother's name was Eleanor Louise Cowell. There are a lot of stories over the years about who his father was, military folks and local people, but none of those could be verified. And there are a lot of rumors out there about the possibility that his grandfather was actually his father, so that he was a product of inbreeding. Now, I couldn't find any evidence to support this, so I kind of have to wonder if people started saying this just kind of as a means to continue to paint him in a bad light or to, I don't know, not justify, but explain how he became the monster that he was. It said that his grandfather, again, who he believed was his father when he was young, was abusive toward both Ted and his mother. So she eventually left with Ted, and they moved to Tacoma, Washington. Now, it's not clear when he found out that this lady he believed was his sister was actually his mother. There, based on what I read and listened to, there are several different points in his life where people would say, it could have been here, but we really don't know. But we do believe that it had a major impact on his life and who he became.
Let's take a quick break and we'll come right back and dig a little deeper.
And we're back. Let's get rolling again. And it's there in Washington that she met and married Johnny Bundy, who would officially later adopt Ted. But, Jamie, they did not have a good relationship. Some interesting stories about Ted when he was younger. I guess he was a shy kid. He was somebody who, I don't know if he made friends very easily or if he was just really introverted or what, but he would also later talk about having some dark fantasies as a kid, and there were some odd things that he did. So he had a weird fascination with knives, and one time his aunt says that she woke up and was going to get up and do something, but she woke up to an arrangement of knives that were around her in bed when Ted was staying over. Jamie, how bad would you freak out if you had a kid over to your house and you woke up to this kind of knife arrangement laying all around you in bed? Wouldn't that be so odd?
First of all, you're going to assume that the kid has hurt themselves or that they're just trying to play with it. But then, I guess hindsight's 20/20. Now you see that and say that he may have had plans to use them.
Yeah. Who knows what his intentions were, but it is weird. I mean, my children, if I woke up to this situation, would be immediately taken to the hospital and assessed for what was going on in their minds. There are other stories from his childhood, Jamie. Apparently, he would break into homes. He would steal things, of course, that didn't belong to him. And there was even opportunities that he would take to spy on women. So just not really good things going on with this kid. He graduated high school in 1965 and enrolled in the University of Puget Sound. Jamie, if I butchered that word, I'm sorry. It sounds like very French, and I'm not French. Then he transferred to the University of Washington.
He did, and when he got to UW, he pretty quickly connected with a young lady, and he had a girlfriend, and the relationship got really serious. We see her name is Stephanie, and if you go online, you see kind of references to what her last name might be, or even if her real first name is Stephanie, but that's how she's referred to. She had long brown hair that was parted in the middle, and she really was his everything, John. They had a very serious relationship. He was trying to study Chinese at the time, and he was not doing well in school, and she became his focus. Also, while in school, he tried to start a political career. He was very involved with the Republican Party there in Seattle. He was actually on the campaign team, or at least helped in the campaign for the re-election of Governor Daniel Evans in Washington in 1972. But going back to when he and Stephanie were together, they broke up in 1968. She didn't feel like he was as dedicated to being successful as she had hoped her future husband would be. He wasn't going anywhere fast enough to please her, so she dumped him, and he was obviously devastated. Again, he had invested kind of everything in her. So he dropped out of Washington University, and he traveled around the country. He enrolled at another school for a term, but eventually he found his way back to the University of Washington. Now, this is one of those spots where some people will say it was also during this time, after Stephanie broke up with him, that he found out that his sister was really his mother. So his whole life is kind of collapsing around him, looking from the outside in, if that truly did happen. But again, we don't know that for sure.
Back at UW, he found himself in another relationship, this time with a single mother named Elizabeth. This was the fall of 1969. Now, he ended up graduating from UW in 1972, and at that time, he went back to law school at the University of Puget for 2 years. And again, I'm sorry if I'm butchering that name. It was in January of 1974 that the first attack from Ted Bundy happened. And, Jamie, this is one of the ones, like, it might be a little stereotypical, but you know your first crime is one of your worst. Like, this is horrible. What happened to this poor lady? So let me tell you a little bit about that. This young woman's name is Karen Sparks. And, Jamie, she was attacked in her sleep. Bundy came in. He sexually assaulted her and beat her nearly to death with a metal rod from her own bed. And he left her there. She left her there for dead. She ended up being in a coma for 10 days, but she survived. And she had some disabilities over the years due to her brain damage, but she was able to eventually tell her story. After that, there seemed to be an attack almost every month, and almost all of them were deadly. This guy is just ramping up, and it is crazy how quickly things escalate.
It is, and escalation is the good word there, and it continues to do that throughout his, I guess, rampage over the next couple of years. And Karen Sparks was the first attack that we know of. Maybe he had others that went even worse for him, but you're right. This did not end in the taking of a life, which we find out later is, I guess, his favorite part of what's happening here. The next victim that we see is Linda Ann Healy. She was a student at the University of Washington. She had gone out with friends and she had left to go turn in early. She was supposed to get up on the radio the next morning and give a ski report. And she would do that. She would have to get up at like 5:30 a.m. So she went to bed a little earlier than most of her friends. She actually lived in a house with a lot of other college students, which makes this story even more bizarre because she was attacked in her bed. So Ted somehow got into the home, got into her room, and attacked her in her bed without being seen. Again, she was bludgeoned. She was sexually assaulted. When Ted had killed her and sexually assaulted her body, he took off her bloody nightgown, hung it up in the closet, and redressed her. He would even go on to make the bed. And then he carried her out of the house without being detected in any way. Nobody even knew that anything had happened to Linda Ann Healy until she didn't get to the radio station the following morning. They called the house to check on her, and when her roommates went to her room, really all they saw was on the made bed, you could see some blood on the pillowcase. And then when they pulled back the blanket, you could see some blood on the sheet. They didn't even see the nightgown or know that anything had happened. So they would call police and police would come. And that's kind of where they were first tipped off to the fact that there was somebody doing these attacks. Linda's jawbone was later discovered several months later, but it's interesting, John. A lot of his victims, their skulls were found or pieces of their skulls, but not necessarily their bodies with them. So he obviously would mutilate and hide these bodies after he had killed these women.
Isn't it crazy how this guy could break into the house, do this horrific murder, go through the process of redressing her and doing all this stuff without anybody else in the house noticing that something was going on? Isn't that just kind of...
It's so scary. And you think about, I mean, not that we live in such a great time that houses are perfect, but think about how creaky houses that old are and the wooden floors. And maybe that was the thing. Maybe it was a house where a lot of college students lived and they were used to people moving around at night and the noise was just a normal thing. I don't know.
Sure. That's a good point. But it makes me glad that I have a security system that I can set at night. And if something happens, I'm going to be woke up to the sound of an alarm going off. But man, over the next 8 months, women would go missing at a rate of at least one per month. Now, we don't know the details of every single murder that happened, but we do know that he had a very similar MO for most of his victims. So let's just kind of run through some of these folks. In March of 1974, 19-year-old Donna Gail Manson was taken and murdered. A month later, 18-year-old Susan Raincourt. in May, a 20-year-old named Roberta Parks. So all these women are college students, and they all go to different schools. We do know some details about what happened on June 11th, which was his kidnapping and murder of Georgianne Hawkins. Now, these details, of course, came from Bundy himself. And I want to say, I don't know how much of this we take as gospel, or if it, some of it was kind of inflated to make him look better. I don't know, but that's unfortunately all we have to go off of. So this is the details as we know it. So what was happening, she was walking home one night and got a little over 60 feet from the door of her house. And that's when she spotted the man on crutches who was struggling to carry something. And he stopped and asked her for help. So she helped. She ran over to the guy. She ran over to his Volkswagen Beetle. And that's when she noticed that the passenger seat of the Volkswagen Beetle had been removed. But she noticed this right before Bundy knocked her unconscious. And just like the other victims, he would bludgeon her, kill her, and rape her before disposing her body, which was never found.
And that's really what he did. He would create some kind of ruse. He used the crutches he had. They eventually found a plaster of Paris in his apartment, which is a device to make casts. So he would put casts on different parts of his body. He would pretend to be different professionals in different fields, and we'll get to a story about that in a little bit. So once he got them to his car, he would debilitate them and usually knock them unconscious and put them there in the floorboard where the seat would go. And you would think that that's not a very likely vehicle to transport a body because they're small, but taking that seat out really did create the room. And when he would debilitate them, then he was in control to kind of do what he wanted with choking them in and out, abusing them, sexually assaulting them. It was really all about power for him. And he unfortunately had an effective way to create a situation where he could use that power. He would often torture them for hours. We mentioned the sexual assault. Sometimes those were before the murder and sometimes they were after. And that's according to Bundy himself. And again, sometimes he would redress the body like he did with Linda and Healy. To Bundy, the possession of the body and the taking of the life was the ultimate satisfaction. It seems the way he told these stories that he really enjoyed the other parts of his crimes, the planning the ruse or the sexually assault parts. But he goes in depth about the possession of the body and what that was like for him. And I'm going to read a quote here. The ultimate possession was, in fact, the taking of the life, and then the physical possession of the remains. Murder is not just a crime of lust or violence. It becomes possession. They are part of you. The victim becomes a part of you, and you are forever one. And the grounds where you kill them or leave them become sacred to you, and you will always be drawn back to them. So, I mean, any quote I feel like you pull out from Bundy is going to sound creepy, and I'll let you know what he did, but that's just, and we're going to talk about this more at the end, but so much evil. When we talk about Ted Bundy, I unfortunately feel like he's more of a celebrity than he is a serial killer to a lot of people, but he was so evil. He would often revisit and relive his crimes. He would take photos of the crime scenes. But it was after he killed Georgianne Hawkins that he made his first major mistake.
Yeah, and that mistake would happen at a beach on Lake Sammamish on July 14th of 1974. So, Jamie, you mentioned they found some plaster of Paris in his house, right? So he had a cast on his arm, and at the beach he asked Janice Ott, who was 23 years old, to help him move something from his boat to his car, which, of course, was a tan Volkswagen Beetle. Now, there were witnesses that heard him approach Janice and introduce himself as Ted, and those people also were able to identify his car. Now, Jamie, he was getting so arrogant at this point that he actually went back to the same beach later the same day and abducted 19-year-old Denise Nosland. Now, remains of both of these young ladies were found close together months later. So at this point, because of those witnesses that heard him approaching Janice, police now have a name of the potential abductor, which is Ted, and they also have an idea what he might drive, which was that Volkswagen Beetle. They also believed, because of the witnesses, that he was using an injury as a trick to be able to lure women into his car.
There were other stories from that day about folks that he tried to lure to his car and couldn't, or some that got close to his car and saw that there was no boat, so knew he was lying and ran away. So, again, there were a lot of folks that escaped becoming a part of this list that we're discussing. So police started putting out this information in the media. They started telling people they were looking for somebody named Ted in a Volkswagen Beetle, and they got a ton of tips. One of those tips actually came from Ted's girlfriend, Elizabeth. She would call police and say, "Listen, I think my boyfriend may be the man that you're looking for. He has stuff in our home that really has no purpose here. He has crutches. He has a plaster of Paris. He has handcuffs. He has all these things that there's no reason for him to have. He's gone for long periods of time with no explanation." And their relationship wasn't going great either. She would say that he was only interested in having sex with her if bondage was involved. And any time that she would refuse to do that, he would get angry with her, like really, really angry and start acting violent, although we don't have a record that he did abuse her directly. And if you add all that to the fact that his name was Ted and he drove a tan Beetle, he made the suspect list. It said that they started investigating each Ted that they got a call about in alphabetical order. Bundy came in at number 3, but before they could get to him, John, he had moved to Salt Lake City, Utah to go to law school. When he had gone back to the University of Washington, he changed his major from Chinese to psychology. He had gotten even more involved in politics and thought that he would go on and be an attorney. Not coincidentally, when he moved to Utah, it was around the same time that the murders in Washington stopped happening. But that certainly doesn't mean that Ted was done. He just now had a new terrain, a new area, and new victims to pursue.
Yeah, on October 18th of 1974, he kidnapped 17-year-old Melissa Smith in Midvale, Utah, and her body was found just a few days later. Within 2 weeks, he would kill again. This time the victim's name was Laura Ann Amy, who was also 17 years old. So, Jamie, this is the scary part to me, man, is he's gone from, he's on the run now, and he's escalating his timeline even faster, right? So he's went from one murder per month to now one every just a couple of weeks, right? So it's in November 8th, 1974, that he really screwed up and blew his cover. So it is believed that he attacked two women that day. The first murder victim was named Deborah Kent, and the second was the one that really started his downfall. He approached 18-year-old Carol Durranche outside of a mall. Now, he would pretend to be a police officer and told her that she needed to file a report about a vehicle being broken into. So he claimed that her vehicle had been broken into and that she needed to go down to the police station and file a report. He even went as far to make it look legit by copying down her license plate number. And Jamie, she just really didn't trust him. She was really hesitant. And when they started driving the opposite way of the police station, she started to protest. So when she starts to protest, Bundy pulls over, and that's when he started attacking her. He attempted to get her in handcuffs, but in the course of the struggle, she was able to get kind of out of his grasp and actually able to get out of the car and was able to escape. And when she escaped, she was able to go find the real police and tell them what had just happened.
Right. And that's really the first person that we have that's immediately goes to police and says, "This person attacked me. And I can tell you these things about him. This is what he did. This is what he said. This is what he looked like." So this is by far the best lead that the police have gotten. Unfortunately, before they were able to find Ted Bundy and to arrest him for Durranche's abduction, he committed several other murders. In January of 1975, he killed 23-year-old Karen Campbell, which is important. We'll come back later. On March 15th of that year, it was 26-year-old ski instructor Julie Cunningham. In April, 24-year-old Denise Oliverson. In May of 1975, John, he drowned a 12-year-old, Lynette Culver, in a bathtub. He would tell people that he had disposed of her body in a river, but her remains were never found. In June of 1975 was the final victim that we know of before he was arrested, and that was 15-year-old Susan Curtis. So his MO in Utah was about the same as it was in Washington. Some of the victims died of head trauma. Others, there was evidence that they were stabbed. All were sexually abused, and most of their bodies were mutilated. All of his victims, John, when you go back and look at pictures of them, resemble his ex-girlfriend Stephanie, the first girl that he dated at the University of Washington that he was so madly in love with. Long, brown hair, parted in the middle. He would finally be caught and arrested on August 16th. He was pulled over kind of in the early hours of that day for not having his headlights on. And when police started looking around his car, they found what they thought were burglary supplies. They saw rope, a crowbar, a mask, gloves, handcuffs, and they didn't know who they had, but they had reason to believe that this guy was up to no good.
That's basically everything you don't want in your car when being pulled over by police, right?
It really is. Like, I don't know. You joke about going to Lowe's and buying duct tape and plastic. This looks a lot worse than that.
If I were innocent and a cop came to my window and I had that stuff sitting nearby, I'd be like, yeah, just take me in. It's cool. I got it. I'll lawyer up. So in October of that year, DeRonch would identify Ted Bundy in a lineup, and that was almost a year after he attempted her abduction. Now, he was charged with aggravated kidnapping and attempted assault, but they had found evidence in his apartment during this investigation, including a map with an X on it, and that was the same spot where Karen Campbell had disappeared from. So during the trial for kidnapping of DeRonch, he was also being investigated for the murder of Karen. Now, he would later say that in his apartment when investigators were looking around, he had a photo album. And inside that album, he kept a picture of every person he had murdered and their crime scene as a trophy. And he would say that investigators overlooked that when searching for that apartment, searching through that apartment. Do you think investigators overlooked this, or do you think this is something he's making up?
I feel like I've given this one maybe a little too much thought, because I just, when you think about them thoroughly going through an apartment, like they picked up the map and looked to see where the X was and looked to see if there were any crimes around that X. So it seems like they were thorough. But how do they miss a photo album? When you're going through somebody's house and they have a photo album on, let's say it's on the nightstand, did they just think that it would be too obvious to leave evidence there, so they ignored it? I would have thought that this would have been something that they found. And he doesn't say it was like hidden under floorboards or anything. So this was a major oversight on their part. I just have trouble picturing how it went down.
Yeah. And I don't think we'll really ever know if that was legit or not. If it was overlooked, you know, it was a bad thing to have overlooked, right? But, you know, I wonder if in fact it was actually there. But anyway, he was convicted of that case. He was convicted of the abduction of DeRonch, and he was sentenced to 1 to 15 years via a bench trial. Now, he waived a jury trial in this case to avoid negative media coverage. But, Jamie, here's the interesting part. During the time, his vehicle was impounded, this Volkswagen Beetle, and they would find hairs that closely matched that of Karen Campbell. That, along with the maps and a credit card receipt putting him at the scene of her abduction, was enough to get him charged with murder.
Yeah, it was enough to get him charged. I don't know. Looking at it now, I feel like the more advanced technology gets, the more specifically hair evidence is being discounted. So I wonder how big of an impact that would make now. I don't know. As I mentioned earlier, Ted had been in law school, and he thought he was, I mean, he had gotten away with all these crimes. He thought he was smarter than everyone else. So he decided that in this trial, he would represent himself. Of course, he was allowed to do so, and the judge let him move about without restraints, so he could move around the courtroom and the courthouse and do research in the law library and those kinds of things. During a pretrial hearing in Glenwood Springs, Utah, kind of in a recess, he asked to go in a law library to work on his case. John had said that he was left in that law library alone for less than 60 seconds, and he jumped out of the second floor window and escaped from the courthouse. Now, you have to wonder, like, is that impulsive? I feel like in the movie with Zac Efron, you see him practicing jumping off his bunk bed to get ready for that. I don't know that there's evidence that that happened. He may have said he did that. But jumping out of a second floor window is risky, right? Like, if you land, I'm going to get my leg broken, and then I'm going to go to jail for murder.
I can't believe this actually happened in real life. Like, it seems like this is the kind of stuff that you make up to make a good movie, but he actually freaking did this.
He did. He did. It wasn't super successful. It was about 6 days that he was quote-unquote free. He had kind of been wandering around. He was hungry. He was sleep-deprived. He stole a car, and he was later pulled over for driving erratically. Again, he was kind of out of it. The officer that pulled him over, John, you talk about bad luck for Bundy, was one of the guys that had been guarding him. He said that he recognized Bundy because he had fed him breakfast the week before that. I mean, I think that's good luck for pretty much everybody else on Earth, but that's an incredible coincidence, I believe. Bundy did have some people talking to him about his case, some legal advisors, if you will. The belief from their point of view was that, yes, there was evidence that put him at the scene of the crime. They had the credit card and the maps, and they had the hairs, but that it probably wasn't enough to get him convicted. It was enough to get him charged, but there was no evidence of him actually killing or knowing Karen or having access to her. So they said, hey, stay here, stop trying to escape, whatever you're doing, go through this trial, and you've got a chance of being acquitted. But obviously, Ted Bundy did not like that advice.
So I'm going to go back to this guard that pulled, or this cop that pulled him over in this car, right? Like, it's the same guard who feeds him breakfast the morning that he escapes from jail and was kind of on guard when he went missing, right? That's the way I understood it. So I feel like this is like a kicker in college football who goes out and misses the kick, like a wide open kick to tie the game, you know what? But he comes back out later and he kicks the winning field goal. Like, I feel like he completely botched his job, but then totally redeemed himself at the same time.
That's got to be such a relief, I think, because I'm sure he was feeling guilty. He's let this murderer go. Some other people are going to be hurt. To get him back in custody, I'm sure was really...
And I'm sure that if he wouldn't have been the one to end up catching Bundy, like, his job's on the line at this point. I wonder if he still lost his job even when he was the one that pulled over Bundy. You know, hopefully not. But anyway, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah,
that we have that. Well, Jamie, with him back in jail, what he needed was a new way to escape, right? So he had this plan. So over time, he started cutting a hole near the light fixture in his cell. And he would also at the same time start cutting himself back on food so that he could lose some weight. So over months of cutting this hole and getting skinnier, Bundy could fit through the hole in his ceiling, which he cut, that would actually lead to a jailer's apartment. And he said that he did this several times in order to make sure the route that he had planned would work. So he would actually sneak through this hole and get up in the apartment, and he would do this multiple times to make sure that he was doing the right thing. On December 30th, 1977, he climbed through the ceiling into the apartment. He would put on civilian clothes and then walked out the front door of this prison. Am I making this crap up?
No, it seems like it, though, right? This is something that if you saw it in a movie, you would not believe it.
So he didn't wander around long. He actually just made a beeline right to Tallahassee, Florida.
Yeah, and some people believe he had help from his girlfriend, and we'll talk more about her here in a little bit. But it almost seemed like his time was coming to an end. He did, as soon as he went to the Midwest, and then he took a bus to Florida, and he got off the bus very near Florida State University. So his targets up to this point have been brunette, college age, and younger girls with hair parted in the middle. I would think on a major college campus, you're going to be able to find a lot of that. So you had mentioned earlier that he had gone from killing people from months apart to weeks apart. And when he got to Florida, it got even faster than that. We're going to start in the early morning hours of January 15th, 1978. That was when he targeted the Chi Omega sorority house. When he got into this house, he actually found a wooden club, and he went and snuck into the room of Margaret Bowman. In that room, he beat her with the club. He strangled her with a nylon stocking until she was dead. Now, her neighbor in that house would later say that she had heard something. She was woken up, but she fell back asleep before getting up to try to find some help. So instead of normally he would go and dispose of this body, maybe continue to abuse it, and then bury it off in the mountain somewhere, or at least that's what he did in Washington. He went down the hall and went in the room of Lisa Levy. Similarly, he bludgeoned her, he strangled her, and then he bit her violently. It said, John, that he bit her so hard that he tore off pieces of her body with his teeth. So, I mean, you think of somebody at this point, it seems he's been in control of all these situations, and control seems to be what he's seeking, power and control, and it seems like he's lost control. After he killed Lisa, he went into a room where roommates Kathleen Kleiner and Karen Chandler were. He attacked them. He bit them, but he left before he was able to kill them, and they both ended up surviving, even though they were obviously traumatized and assaulted. They also had bite marks that would be evidence later, and then he fled the scene. He left the Chi Omega house, and that entire attack, killing two, injuring two, took less than 10 minutes.
He would end up going down the street and broke into the apartment of Cheryl Thomas. He starts attacking her. He ends up breaking her jaw. He would end up damaging her hearing, but Jamie, she actually survived this attack. So when this happened and all the things you just mentioned, obviously the community was very rattled, right? So this would actually set the stage for the panic that we covered a few weeks ago in the Gainesville Ripper episode. So all this was happening around the same time. But they didn't know that they were looking for Ted Bundy. They didn't know they were looking for a murderer who was on the run. Bundy had always disposed of his victims' bodies, but they were discovered much later. But this was like a rampage by an evil man. Just over 2 months later, February of 1978, Bundy murdered Kimberly Leach. Jamie, this one's tough, man. She was only 12 years old when she was murdered by Ted Bundy. He somehow managed to abduct her during the middle of a school day. After her murder and abduction, he would decide that it was time to flee Florida. So he stole a car, and he left town. You know what kind of car he stole, Jamie?
I've heard stories about the fact that he had a mentor kind of in his political beginnings as helping with the Republican Party. That mentor drove a Volkswagen Beetle, and it's amazing that we see him in so many states. And like, we always reference this Beetle, but it wasn't all the ways the same one. He just always came up with one. And is that what he was driving out of Florida?
That was it. I think if I'm Ted Bundy, the last car I choose to rob is a Volkswagen Beetle. Is it a good time to say that I used to drive a tan Volkswagen Beetle?
I've been thinking it absolutely the entire time.
It was a nice car. I mean, I get it. It's just odd that if you want to be a little inconspicuous, maybe don't steal the same car that you've been arrested in a couple of times. But anyway, he would drive this car, and he did something which made him seem suspicious to officers. So he ended up getting pulled over. Now, it took police a while to figure out exactly who this guy was and to connect the dots to all those crimes out of Washington, Colorado, and Utah. But eventually, it became clear that they had just caught Ted Bundy, who was wanted for multiple murders.
He again decided to act as his attorney, and it was really just disgusting, John. He was in charge of interrogating members of the Chi Omega sorority house as part of their deposition. And it became obvious pretty quickly that he wasn't trying to get information from them or get statements from them. He was using their testimony to relive his crimes and to go over those gory details. And it was absolutely repulsive. First, he was tried for the murder of Margaret Bowman and Lisa Levy. He was convicted of that crime. And then also part of that case was the attempted murder of Kathleen Kleiner, Karen Chandler, and Cheryl Thomas. But for the murders, he was sentenced to death by electric chair. In the next year, in 1980, he was tried for the murder of Kimberly Leach. He was also convicted of that murder and sentenced to death. I don't want to brush over the entire trial. It was really a circus. Like, he made a mockery of our justice system. in the courtroom, which drew an amazing amount of attention, particularly from females, which a lot of people would just, kind of speculate on why that was. In the courtroom, he was somehow both charismatic and repulsive, intelligent, and did some of the dumbest stuff ever. John, this is another one of those stories that you can't believe happened. He got married during the proceeding.
Seems like a pretty legit woman, right?
So this was Carol Ann Boone, who was his girlfriend, who they believed had provided him with money on his second escape to get to Florida. But she was on as a character witness for him during his the sentencing part of his trial for Kimberly Leach. So at this point, he's already going to be on death row. There was a really odd law in Florida that with two people declaring their desire to be married during a court proceeding in front of a judge, then that legally married them. So while Carol was on the stand, he asked her if she wanted to marry him. He declared he wanted to marry her. And at that point, they were legally married. And while he was in jail awaiting being his execution, he and Carol would actually go on to conceive a daughter. And you can even find stories, it's not like they had conjugal visits, about how they were able to do that, which I don't want to go into.
That is very interesting. I must have missed that in my research of this case.
I wish I had missed it.
I'll have to go back and check that out. But, man, he would try to prolong his execution by giving details about his crimes. Ultimately, he confessed to 36 murders, although many people believe that number to be actually much larger than what he would confess to. They were able to corroborate many of his stories, but not all of them, which, you know, that's pretty typical when we're talking about serial killers, right?
Yeah, it is. And like you mentioned it earlier when we were talking about one of the crimes, we get most of these details from him about his interactions with his victims, the way they reacted to him. So it's, I don't know, we know that he killed a lot of people and we know that he gave us a lot of accurate details, but we don't know if everything he said really checked out.
This is another interesting side note. Bundy was asked to help out in the case by a detective who was trying to find the person behind the Green River murders. So this act of Ted Bundy helping this detective find a killer inspired the premise of a movie, The Silence of the Lambs and the Hannibal Lecter series. So in those movies, the killer, Buffalo Bill, actually wore a cast to help abduct victims in the movie, much like Ted Bundy did.
He did. And I mean, just the fact that there was a serial killer on a profiling group helping to catch criminals. I don't know. It's just so odd to think about the fact that it's almost like he was an expert in the field that they were studying and they brought him in to get his content. Now, they did catch the Green River killer, but it was years and years later, and I'm not sure Bundy's work had a real impact on that. The day before Ted Bundy was executed, John, he sat down with Reverend James Dobson, and it said that he found faith in prison and all those things. But he basically told Dobson that all of this, everything he did, was because he watched and looked at pornography as a child. So he blamed all of his actions on that. He was blasted across the board by criminals and Christians and political people alike, saying that that was just stupid, but that was what he said. He was ultimately executed at 7:16 a.m. on January 24th of 1989. Hundreds of people were outside the prison celebrating his execution, John. They were selling t-shirts, setting off fireworks. They were cheering and chanting. Later on, his body would be cremated, and his ashes were scattered somewhere in Washington, according to his will. John, the story of Ted Bundy is both scarier and more outlandish than I think anybody really would believe if we didn't have evidence to back these things up. And I know we've covered cases like that before, but for him to be so notorious for what he did and for him to escape prison twice in really ridiculous ways and get married in court and advise a profiling group, all those things are crazy, but I feel like now we kind of view him differently from other serial killers. I mean, we talked about Ed Gein a few weeks ago, and we think about him being this gross guy that hid in this house. And we've done a BTK episode, and we talked about, yes, he lived a normal life, but he was really creepy and really evil. But when people talk about Ted Bundy, it's almost like they're talking about a celebrity. Why do you think that he's different?
I think, and this is going to sound kind of weird, man, but I think it's because he doesn't look like a criminal. He looks like a good-looking dude who you would put a lot of trust in. He just looks like a normal human being. But he would use that and his charm to do every evil act that he committed. So I don't know if I'm way off there or not, but I think it's just because his appearance, he doesn't, you would walk past him on a street and not suspect anything. And there's a lot of criminals out there that you walk by on the street and you're like, oh, I bet you murder people at night.
Right.
You know? And that sounds probably weird, but he just doesn't fit when you're just looking at appearances. And, you know, he's attended school and has done really well for himself. He doesn't fit the mold of your stereotypical bad guy, evil person.
You can find some pretty fascinating debates online about, there's a large group of people that constantly talk about how good looking and how hot Ted Bundy was. Then there's a group of people who think it's disgusting that anybody would call him attractive since he did what he did. Then there's another group that says, he's not that good looking anyway. But there are some, like, it's pretty heated online. If you get on any forum where people comment and say that he was attractive, there's so much backlash there. And I understand it. Maybe he did have good looks. Maybe he would have been a successful politician because he was charismatic and tall and good looking if he had not also been a mass murderer. What caused him to become this way? I mean, I want to throw the inbreeding prospect out the window. I don't see any evidence for that. But he was raised in a very odd situation.
His situation was odd, but I can't say because of what I do that it's much different than a lot of other people in this world who have some pretty awful upbringings and some pretty, I'm not going to say weird, but some pretty different things happened to him. And his family situation was different, where he was raised by somebody that he thought was a different kind of relationship to him. So I can't put all that on that situation, because a lot of people have issues like that and turn out not to be killers and murderers and abductors. So I think he had a lot of severe mental health issues. I think, it's hard to put all of this evil on one thing, right? Like mental health. There's a lot of people with mental health issues that don't kill anybody.
Right.
But, you know, maybe it was just the perfect storm of genetics, mental health, his upbringing. All of those things culminated into the person he became. But a lot of it is you have to have personal accountability for the things that you do. And even with all those things working against him, he made a choice each time he abducted and harmed one of these people to do what he did. So at the end of the day, it rests on him.
And the accountability piece, I mean, he did admit a lot of his crimes. And then he was executed 9 years after he was convicted. Is that justice here, John?
Well, I would like to see a conviction for every one of the murders that he did. We don't see that, so I can't say that justice was necessarily served for every one of his victims. But the fact that he was executed and is not still alive, and he was executed for his crimes, that's the most justice we can get. But again, I'd like to see a conviction for every single person that he ever hurt.
Right. And we don't have that, and we're not going to get that at this point. But we do know there were a lot of victims. And we also know that he, I hate to use this word as it pertains to murder, but inspired a lot of other killers, or at least gave them kind of a guidebook for how he got away with it. And I think he leaves a very unfortunate legacy in that way. But guys, that's our 100th episode. We have had some cases that have taken a couple episodes, but this is our 100th episode of True Crime Cast. If you've been along with us for this entire ride, we greatly appreciate you. If you started listening today for the first time, we greatly appreciate you. We're so thankful for the support and the fact that people care enough to download this, and we're very humbled by it.
Yeah, guys, thank you so much. This has been a long, awesome ride, and we're excited for 100 more. I mean, I don't see any putting the brakes on anytime soon, do you, brother?
I don't. If you would like to get us a gift for our 100th episode, you should go and download the short Wondery commercials we've been posting on our feed. I think we're on the verge of something big happening, and getting a lot of numbers of downloads on that would go a great way toward helping us.
So go ahead, mosey on over there. But before you do, I just want to say thanks one more time. And until next crime, this has been True Crimecast.
You've listened to True Crimecast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.